This is an Overcoat Media production.
Welcome to Memento Morbid, where we explore death, life, and the in-between. It's hosted by me, Joanna Ebenstein, founder of Morbid Anatomy, an organization and community devoted to these very themes. Hello. During this episode of Memento Morbid, if any names, books, ideas, or artworks spark your curiosity, check out the podcast show notes for more. You'll also find a link to our Substack, which contains imagery discussed and additional content. Today, I am delighted to welcome Paul Giamatti. Paul Giamatti is an award-winning American actor, producer, and lifelong enthusiast of the strange, esoteric, and occult.
I had an actual ghostly experience. We all did. I was doing a production of Hamlet, a very weird play with lots of weird energy in it. And so I came out. I had the knife on me. I had the knife on me all the time. I did that speech, and I'm berating her, and I'm circling her. And all of a sudden, I thought, my knife is gone. After an intermission, which people went out, all the stagehands went out and looked everywhere for this fucking knife. And the stage manager says to me, your knife is in the middle of this set piece that came down from 40 feet in the air. My knife was lying on the stair, right where I was supposed to walk through.
Wow. Before we bring in our guest, let's enjoy a listener's story, question, or encounter revolving around death positivity.
Hi, I'm Lauren Seeley, and I live in Brooklyn, New York. So one of the stories that sticks out to me the most of death-related stories from working in the death space is the day that I was tasked with cutting the hair of a young woman who had recently passed. I hadn't yet seen or met her, but that day when I went in, I went to her casket, I lifted off the lid. I was shocked because she looked like me. She was heavily tattooed like me. She was wearing the exact same outfit that I wore the day that I got married, and she had the exact same shoes, which were not just any shoes. They were a special pair of Swedish shoes, and she had the same color flowers around her that I had. So I'm standing there in absolute disbelief that I'm basically looking at myself and what my mortality could look like. Yeah, I'm standing here, I'm getting ready to cut her hair, and this is the interesting part. So she had long hair. I cut pretty much all of it off to be able to make a beautiful hair memento mori piece to go home with her. And by the time I was done cutting her hair, I was even more shocked by the resemblance and the synchronicities of working with her, because I had a shaved head when I got married. And after cutting all of her hair, she also had a bald head. And so I'm standing there and just looking at her and thinking to myself, and she's about the same age as me, and thinking, someday this is going to be me.
Thank you so much. If you have your own offering, a reflection, memory, or encounter that you'd like to share, please send us a WhatsApp voice note. You will find the number in the episode description. Just add it to your contacts. Best known for his starring roles in cult classics such as Sideways, The Illusionist, and American Splendor, Paul Giamatti also makes recent appearances in The Holdovers, Star Trek, and a memorable death and grief-themed episode of Black Mirror called Eulogy. Paul is also the co-host of a podcast called Chinwag, which is devoted to ghosts, mysticism, altered states, UFOs, and the mysterious. His co-host on that show is Stephen Asma, a philosopher and scholar of the imagination, an author of a book called On Monsters. And Paul, I don't know if you know this, but he was also a big influence on the creation of Morbid Anatomy through reading his book, Stuffed Animals and Pickled Heads. So he's been very important in both of our lives. And I think you met him through our organization. Is that right?
I did. I saw him give a talk on imagination and brain function and things like that. And it was super interesting. I was online. It was 2020.
Okay.
And it was, you know, when everybody was in the depths of the pandemic, and I was up on Cape Cod and in a house, weird, spooky house alone. And I just tuned in to check him out, and I thought he was great.
He is great. And so how did that develop into a podcast?
Well, I contacted him just to say hi and say, you know, I mean, I had a lot of time on my hands. So I was like, this guy seems interesting. And I contacted him, and he responded, and we started talking on Zoom, and we had a great time and found that not only did we have interests in common, but we got along really well. And we became friends over Zoom. We were, you know, one day he said, I should record these conversations we're having, because we were talking about a lot of random things and, you know, big wide swath of stuff. And we don't do it anymore. We've stopped. No, we did it for about 2 years. Steve does a thing on YouTube. He's continued to do his own show on YouTube.
The Monsters thing?
Yeah. It was just too crazy with my schedule and his schedule. And maybe someday we'll do some other version of it or something. We talk about it.
Yeah. And so the themes that you explore on that show definitely have a lot of alignment with the Morbid Anatomy themes, which I guess is why it makes sense that you ended up finding us. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about those sorts of unusual things that you're interested in and how you got interested in them in the first place, if you can even say.
Yeah, it's hard to say, isn't it? Why? I mean, it goes all the way back into very early childhood. I mean, I've been interested in, and this is something Stephen and I really connected on, monsters, I think is probably what it really started out with as a very, very little kid. And I'm saying, you know, 4 years old, maybe 5 years old.
Wow.
I can very distinctly remember being fascinated with monsters in general, monster movies and things like that. And a lot of it was coming through movies. It was coming through the old Universal horror movies, Frankenstein and the werewolf in particular, Wolfman.
The real classics.
Yeah, Wolfman in particular was very, very sparky thing to
What me. About the Wolfman, can you say? Because I haven't heard many people pinpoint the Wolfman as being a...
The Wolfman and werewolves in particular were extremely interesting to me as a kid. And also Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, who is a kind of werewolf,
totally.
I suppose.
Well, it's like a shapeshifter.
Yes. And it's also a guy who's kind of animal side is manifesting. Mm-hmm. I was fascinated by Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I was fascinated by the Island of Dr. Moreau when I was a little kid, too. I saw Island of Lost Souls with Charles Laughton when I was a little kid, and these sort of half man, half animals. So I was definitely very interested in, and have remained interested in always, people changing into an animal or people caught between two things of I'm a human, I'm an animal, I'm a human, I'm an animal. So that for some reason had some very deep resonance for me as a kid. Interesting. As I'm talking to you about it now, I'm realizing, oh, I'd never really thought about this that much. But that was definitely the early sort of seeds of something.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting too. You know, while I was preparing for our conversation, I was just thinking a lot about acting and theater and cinema and all of these things. And in a way, hearing you talk about the werewolf and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, there is an element of becoming someone else, which is really what you do for a living and very powerfully, I should say, you know?
Yeah. Well, no, but yeah. And when I think about it, it does have something, there's something very interesting to me about people turning into something else or people transforming into something else.
Yeah.
And the bodies transforming into other things. And that's very, very interesting to me.
Yeah. And do you think there is some link between your attraction to acting and that kind of formative?
Probably. Yeah, probably. I mean, yeah. I mean, I think as a little kid, I think I felt the power of going, I'm a monster now. Mm. You know, I'm like a little 4 year old kid, but in my mind, I was a terrifying monster and I could change into whatever. And so, yes, and that was very powerful. And I can remember very early experiences of acting, sort of in like kindergarten when you're all just doing some play, everybody's getting together and just doing a play, you know, you're all pretending. And I remember doing a thing where we were being pirates, and I can remember being so specific about what I looked like. So in my mind, I knew exactly what I looked like, and I knew exactly how big I was and what kind of giant mustache I had and what kind of, like, it was very, very vivid to me what I looked like. And so I don't know, it definitely must have something to do. Yeah. And then as I got older, that aspect of changing and not being what you are became interesting to me for different reasons. I became, as I got older, fascinated by hoaxes and con artists and fooling people and magic and things like that, too. And so tricking people became also interesting to me too. The fact that I'm tricking people in a sort of benign way became very interesting to me too.
Yeah, well, it's interesting to me because this is kind of the liminal space that acting occupies in a way, right? It is like a, it's using deception and using illusion to create real emotional change. You know, I was watching something last night. I was just thinking, you know, of the power of this medium, of these people act, you know, getting dressed up and being in settings and performing that can elicit tears in us, you know, that can really bring us to incredible places. And there is, you know, I was just thinking about your love of the supernatural, and I was thinking there is so much supernatural when it comes to acting. I would imagine, well, I would love to hear you talk about that. As far as like talking about like envisioning that pirate, right? Is that kind of not that dissimilar to the process now when you get into a role? Like,
yeah, probably not that different. I don't think it's that different. No, really. It hasn't changed that much. You know, and in some ways, the outward physical things are very interesting to me, to feel different, to do something where I look at myself and I'm different or I feel different. Even just cutting my hair in a different way, like, can make me feel very different. You know, there's all kinds of things that can go into making you feel certain, you know, but a lot of it's exterior stuff. And you know, I used to, for a long time, and still sometimes do, I draw as well. I like to draw.
Your character, you mean?
And I used to draw my characters. I mean, I draw in general, but I used to draw my characters. And I still do it sometimes. And actually, recently, I did this movie, The Holdovers, a couple years ago. I had forgotten that I had drawn that character. And before, when I first was talking about doing the movie and had read the script, I was drawing it. And I found those drawings again not that long ago. And I ended up looking like what I had drawn. And it was like I had already had some sort of idea about what this guy was going to be. And I was actually sort of like, oh, that's really interesting how much I ended up looking like the drawing that I did. And that was cool. But yeah, there's a lot of mystical strangeness to acting.
Yeah,
definitely. I mean, the whole thing is strange and weird. And what are you doing? What the fuck are you doing? It's very weird. And it's incredibly powerful.
Yeah.
You can access people so fast and so deep, the audience, but the other actors too.
That's really interesting. You know,
I saw somebody, an actor I hadn't seen in 20 years that I worked with 20 years ago. And I saw this person and you almost, what we had done 20 years ago was a very emotional thing together. We saw each other and started laughing and crying and hugging each other because the depth of what you establish, and I've not seen this person for 20 years. Wow. And it was like I was seeing somebody from my family or something, but it was almost even more powerful than that. You know, like the bonds you connect are really powerful with people. It's crazy.
And when you're working to get into character, you know, like I've heard, there's a lot of people who kind of compare acting to channeling or all these things. Like I think there's so many mysteries involved in any creative process. But I think in acting in particular, because you're really, I mean, one way of looking at it is almost like possession, right? You're allowing yourself to be possessed by another personality and actually inviting that in. I wonder how your experiences of acting have been. Has it felt mysterious, supernatural? You know, I don't want to stretch it, but do you know what I mean? I think
No. No, and I don't really talk about this. This is the one place I feel comfortable talking about it, actually, because there's a lot of it. And it's like I don't talk about it much. You can feel like you enter all kinds of different states. I mean, I've never really had the experiences acting on film that I've had on stage.
That's interesting.
The place where the really kind of wild, transformative, mystical, supernatural things happen on stage for me, because I think everything's live and everybody's right there and you're experiencing things in real time. That's one thing for sure. And you would have that simple experience, which everybody's had in different ways, but you have it a lot as an actor on stage of, I would say that it was like, I mean, I guess it's called flow is what people call it. But you'd have those moments. I would say it was like I had 1,000 eyes and 1,000 arms. Wow. And it was like I couldn't make the wrong move. I couldn't do the wrong thing. Everything, I was in command of 5 dimensions of space at once. You just know everything that's happening around you. You're completely aware of the audience, the other person. You're completely in this thing. And it's just flowing absolutely seamlessly in this kind of amazing way. I mean, I've had lots of weird experiences. I've had very significant dreams that have affected things. But I had an actual ghostly experience. We all did. And everybody on stage at the moment, I was doing a production of Hamlet. And, you know, Macbeth is the play that has a lot of the sort of spooky mojo around it. But I actually think Hamlet does too. Hamlet's a ghost story, and it's a fucking weird play. A very weird play with lots of weird energy in it. And we were doing a production of it. We had made the choice that when the ghost of Hamlet's father appears to him, he gives Hamlet a knife. He hands Hamlet a knife, and I take a knife, and I had that knife with me for the rest of the play until I kill Polonius with it. And in our production, it was a sort of World War I era kind of like Austro-Hungarian Empire kind of thing. He gave me this enormous bayonet, this kind of like military bayonet. It was pretty big and it was heavy. And so I wore it and had to do the to be or not to be speech, which goes right into the scene with Ophelia, with the get thee to a nunnery. And so I came out, I had the knife on me. I had the knife on me all the time. And I did that speech. And then it moves right into the lights changed and you saw Ophelia over there and I moved over there and I'm having this whole speech and I start getting worked up and I'm berating her and I'm circling her. And all of a sudden I thought, my knife is gone. And I was like, fuck happened to my knife? And I was circling the stage and I was like, this is the other really cool thing that happens when you're acting is you have two brains operating. I'm saying all of this Shakespearean stuff and I'm doing all this. And I'm also thinking, where's my fucking knife? And I was kind of looking around the stage and I could see that she also was thinking, what happened to his knife? And I could see her sort of, so we couldn't find the knife. And I went off stage. I said, where the fuck did my knife go? And everybody was like, I don't know. It wasn't on the stage. Wasn't anywhere. And the play goes on. We got another knife. I put it on another knife. There's a scene where Polonius is praying and I'm supposed to come in and I'm going to stab him with this knife. And a piece of scenery came in from the flies. Comes down and it had sort of steps on it that I had to step over through these archways. So the thing flies in. Now, this was after an intermission, which people went out, all the stagehands went out and looked everywhere for this fucking knife. Did it slide off this? But you would have heard it. You would have seen it.
Yeah.
So the thing flew in at the top of this act. The lights come up. He's praying. And the stage manager says to me, your knife is in the middle of this set piece that came down from 40 feet in the air. My knife was lying on the stair, right where I was supposed to walk through. It got 40 feet up in the air somehow onto this. Even if somebody had taken it up there, they would have had to climb out onto the thing and put it out there. And the other thing is, after the show, I saw a friend of mine, and he said to me without my even saying to him, hey, what happened to your knife?
I noticed.
In that scene, because I noticed all of a sudden you had your knife, and all of a sudden in the middle of the scene, you didn't have your knife.
Wow.
So a guy in the audience suddenly noticed I didn't have my knife. Anyway.
That's crazy.
You know, so isn't that crazy?
That is crazy. And I love what you were talking about, too, about these plays having these energies, you know? Like, I wonder if there's a whole oral tradition of weird stuff that happens around productions of this play.
Oh, you know? For sure. No, there's definitely weird things I think that happen with Hamlet. And Macbeth's the famous one that happens. One of my favorite stories is an original production of Dr. Faustus, of Christopher Marlowe's Dr. Faustus. Has a great story that I love, that I've always wanted to write something about or base it on or something. And that was that there was a guy named... his name, Edward something. He was a famous actor at the time. He was Queen Elizabeth's one of his favorite actors, and he was playing Faustus, and he was apparently just a sensation, terrifying to watch him sort of like be overtaken with diabolical powers and stuff, to the extent that people thought he was starting to be able to have actual diabolical powers. And supposedly in one production, one performance of it one day, he was doing an incantation where he calls up all these demons. And there were supposed to be six demons appear. And by the account of a Puritan at the time, one demon too many appeared.
Wow.
which I've always thought was a great title for something, One Demon Too Many. But he has summoned somebody that wasn't supposed to be there.
Have you thought about doing that as a
I don't know. I mean, it's just the idea, I've always thought it'd be interesting to do something about an actor who's losing his mind and starting to see. And I always thought it'd be interesting to film stuff on stage and he starts seeing somebody who's not supposed to be there or something. I don't know. I just thought it'd be an interesting take on a guy and the actor losing his mind.
Yeah, but it just brings up so many of these really fascinating issues around performing arts, you know, which is what is real and what's not real. How can doing something that you don't believe is real maybe actually elicit changes in the world that are mysterious? It actually makes me think of a book, and because I know you are a bibliophile and a book collector, which I wanted to ask you about. Have you ever read the book The Death and Resurrection Show by Rogan Taylor? From Shaman to Superstar?
No.
It's amazing. It's this anthropological look at the relationship between shamanism and performing arts.
Amazing. My acting the one acting teacher I ever had used to talk about how you talked about shamanism a lot. He would bring it up a lot, that we were sort of channeling things. And that was this grave responsibility because you could do yourself and other people damage, and you can. You know, I mean, that sounds melodramatic, but you can.
It doesn't to me when you think, you know, I think of watching a TV show.
I wouldn't think you guys, I wouldn't think you would find it weird, which is why I can say it.
There's almost this way that we behave as if acting or theater or film are not important, you know? And I think when you look at the money that is going into this industry, clearly something is happening that is really important and that we need, you know? So I think pretending it's not important and, you know, pretending we're not all sitting in a room wiping away tears, you know, and that's not real and that doesn't make us grow, even though it's not real, you know, it's artifice. It would be hard to deny that there's importance there. But going back to your bibliophile ways, I would love to know more about the kind of books you collect and what your library is like.
Oh, geez. You can see some books
back
there.
I can see a few.
I do. I collect a lot of books. I mean, it's funny. I collect lots and lots of genre stuff that I like. I have tons and tons of sci-fi. Horror, mysteries, thrillers, things like that. A lot of them are old because I like the old copies. I like the old covers. You know, they may not be worth, some of them are worth money, but a lot of them aren't worth that much. But I just like them because of the covers and things like that. I had a huge collection of sort of esoteric occult things like that. I got rid of a lot of it wanting to make room for more. I have an enormous section of kind of Western Americana. Like, I'm fascinated by the American West and stuff like that. I have a lot of books about espionage, but you know, the preponderance of what I have is probably science fictional related or horror. You know, horror novels.
And have you done writing of your own, or are you interested in writing?
I would love to try to write. I lately have been trying to, just for my own edification, I would like to. I used to, when I was a kid, I loved to write. I think I had part of me thought maybe I'll be a writer. And I think there's an interesting connection between writers and actors, creating characters and inhabiting stories. And to me also, in some ways, writing is the most amazing art form to me because there's just nothing. There's nothing. It's just this like weird little dots on a page, and you just hand it to somebody else and it happens to them. You hand it to the other person, the same thing happens to them. That's also mysterious and creepy and weird and like magical and powerful. But I would love to, I'll try, but I don't, my body chemistry, I think, is more attuned to like getting up and running around and being a monster than sort of sitting and writing.
Being the monster rather than writing the monster.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I could see it. Well, I mean, I feel like many book collectors, myself included, secretly want to be writers, or just because you read so much, it's just so second nature to communicate in that form too, you know?
But do you feel, I mean, I feel like I'm a little bit paralyzed by how much I read. If I had to try to sit down and write, I'm just like, wow.
I think you'd be surprised, Paul. I think that the goal for me, well, of course, it's my creative practice, so it's different, right? But I think for me, I'd say similarly to how you're talking about acting, there is a channeling element. It's like once you turn your intention and you've committed to it, which usually for me comes from the signing of a contract and the receiving of an advance, then suddenly, whether I want to or not, It's always processing in the background. And when I sit down to write, there it is. And why, where it came from, I can't tell you. It doesn't feel like me, but I made the choice to do it. I bring my skills to bear in the editing and in, you know, how it's shaped. I think it's a lot like acting, probably. It's just like open.
No, that does sound like it. Yeah. All right. Well, I'll try at some point.
I'm happy to give you advice if you ever want some. It's fun. It's really fun.
Yeah.
When I was doing research about your career, I also found something that I was really excited to hear, which is a rumor that you are being slated to play the legendary paranormal radio host Art Bell in an upcoming film. Is that true?
Yes, it is. Yeah. Yes. I was very excited.
Can you tell our listeners who might not be as familiar with Art Bell as we are, like who he is and what drew you to the project?
I mean, he was a late night radio host. He had a show called Coast to Coast Radio, which played nationally midnight to the morning, basically. I'm thinking of him sort of in the 80s and 90s when I would listen to him. And he was on for a while, and he himself was a kind of a mysterious guy in some ways. And he broadcast out of a place out in the desert, and his topics ranged from all kinds of, you know, I mean, Bigfoot and UFOs, and I mean, you name it, he covered everything. And it was a phone-in thing too. He'd have a guest, but people would also call in, and you know, it was classic late night talk radio. It was absolutely classic. And he was amazing. I mean, he had a great voice. Yeah. He was a great character.
Yeah.
Had a kind of crazy life himself, from what the little I know of it. And so, yeah, somebody wanted to make a movie. The idea is to do a kind of nice mashup of kind of science fiction and horror.
I've heard a few of those Art Bell episodes. The other thing I feel like is so remarkable about them is just the sense of like, maybe because he was recording in the desert, but the sense of like creepy isolation, like it almost gave me the chills just to hear the sound
just
quality of where he was, right?
Totally.
There was something
absolutely
frightening.
No, and one thing I've said to them that is, if nothing else, you have to capture that weird lonely sense of a lonely voice coming out of the desert in the middle of the night.
It felt
and
dangerous.
Talking about and it felt edgy, and it felt kind of... Yeah. Like exploitative. It felt like an exploitation. It felt like a cheap horror movie where you're a little bit like, are these people real? Did they really kill somebody? It's like one of those Italian zombie movies where you're like, did they actually kill somebody in this? Because this is so disturbing and weird. Like, where were they? Who are they? What the fuck is going on in this movie? You know, it's like it verges into very kind of like creepy territory. And he did get involved with a lot of like kind of real nutty conspiracy theorists and stuff like that. And, you know, he interviewed a lot of these guys who said that they had, you know, been with dead aliens and Area 51 and stuff like that. And that got very complicated and weird and with him and stuff. So it definitely has a creepy edge to it. Yeah.
Well, I really hope this film happens because I think
me too.
Art Bell, there's a whole generation that's never heard of Art Bell, but people of our generation, it's like this strange, like almost rite of passage to listen to Art Bell, right?
Totally. That music and everything was all very distinctive.
It freaked me out. I remember
his voice.
Well, I had a friend who really loved it. And I was like, I have to do it in small doses because it
scared
me.
Yeah, and it's something that's really lost because of the, like, you know, the internet and stuff like that. I mean, you had to really like find it on the radio.
Yes, and it was AM radio, wasn't it?
Yeah,
so, like,
and yes,
crackly.
Yeah, totally. So it was really crackly and creepy, and like, and so many times I can remember being in a car late at night driving somewhere and listening
creepy,
to it.
Right?
It's already creepy. You're alone on a creepy road, and you're listening to it. So it has, it has that wonderful. Hopefully that's a thing that they capture in it, because I'm like, that's the whole
thing. I hope
they do,
too. I feel like they could watch Twin Peaks The Return for that feeling. I feel like all the driving scenes in that with Bad Cooper had that kind of really dark feeling, like anything could happen.
Yes, and there's a very Twin Peaks feel to Art Bell, too. Yeah. There's a very much, that makes sense. There's a good overlap in those two things.
Yeah.
It feels very David Lynch. Yeah, too bad he's not around to make an Art Bell movie. That
Great. I mean, could we even wish for something so great?
But they've talked a lot about David Lynch
Have
in
they?
Relation to this.
Okay,
movie. As a kind of tonal thing, they've talked about him.
This all sounds very promising. I really hope it happens because it sounds like they've got the right vibe, you know?
Yeah, hopefully.
And what a great role. Another thing I was thinking about when I was preparing for this is a show that you produced, Lodge 49.
Yeah.
And I would love to hear you talk a little bit about it. And I know it had a grander vision than what you were able to achieve, unfortunately. And I wonder if you could just kind of talk a little bit about that and what drew you to that project and wanting to champion it.
I'm really happy you mentioned it because I always like to talk about that thing whenever I can because it was like a blip.
I wouldn't have known about it except my friend told me to see.
Well, it is truly amazing that it got made at all, considering they all thought it was so weird. I didn't think it was weird, but it isn't in some ways really that weird.
No,
it's like a very accessible show, actually. You know, it's very much about just these ordinary people.
I call it weird, but call it unusual because it didn't follow like the tropes of normal TV. So there was a really nice feeling where you just weren't quite sure what it was going to do, and that was a wonderful.
No, and I
feeling.
Think that's because the guy who wrote it and created it is a short story writer and a novelist. Wow. He was not a TV writer. He was not. He was coming to it with he happened to have an amazing knack for it, but it was not, it unfolded more like a novel than it did a traditional TV show.
Yes.
So I found a lot of people saying to me, what's going on in this show? It moves really slowly and nothing happens. And I'm like, everything happens in this show. Just stick with it. It doesn't move in the same way. It's sort of like, but it's incredibly carefully constructed and written. And it's a really beautiful show. I'm so glad that you liked it. And we only got two seasons of it made. It's amazing. Two seasons it got made. Jim Gavin, the guy who wrote it, conceived of four seasons, water, earth, fire, air. If you see the show, the first season ends with something that happens in the water. The second season ends with something that happens where the guy gets buried under all this earth. And it's like every one of them had a different sort of theme for the different elements and stuff like that, because the show's all about alchemy. And I loved it. And I just loved that show. And we tried to save it and it didn't work. And nobody would take it on because people just didn't get it or something. And there's not much to get, really. It was like, it's not that mysterious.
Yeah.
You know, there's just, it's about people turning their shitty lives into gold.
Yeah. I loved it. And I love how relatable it was and how much it also spoke of this particular historical moment we're in, you know, where so many people, it just seems insurmountable to get out of just the mundanity of everyday life, you know, and it really captured that. And the characters were great. And for those listeners who have not seen it, I really recommend checking out. It's charming too. Yeah. It does have a novelistic pace. I think that's a nice way of thinking about it. It unfolds, but it unfolds slowly, but that's part of it. It feels like to me, their lives have a slow pace and it's a very California feel. And it's about these relationships between these people. And it's beautiful. And you make a cameo in it as well, don't you?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. Which wasn't supposed to really happen.
Really?
I was just supposed to, I didn't want to be in it at all. There was a part of it that was enjoying just helping to get it made.
Right. And that, Vane, are there any other projects that you've thought about getting behind that have landed on your desk right now?
Sure. I mean, over the years, I've made different things. And there's a movie I did called Cold Souls. Cold Souls is a movie about a guy who discovers there's a technology to have your soul removed. Yeah, it's a weird little movie. But other things, sure. I mean, there's always things that we're trying. The guy who wrote Lodge 49 wrote a series that was a kind of mashup of the occult and a spy, Cold War spy thing. And that proved to be also too weird for people, which just drives me crazy. It was really not that weird. He then kind of took that and spun it into a script, which we've been trying to make.
Oh,
and it's got a kind of Wicker Man feel to it. We've been trying to make a movie for decades about Philip K. Dick. It's a really smart script because it's just about one incident in his life. Mm. So it becomes a movie about all those kind of Phil Dick, kind of, who's a big hero of mine. All those kind of Phil Dick, like what's real, what's not, what's consciousness, you know, am I dead, am I alive? You know, all this like kind of crazy stuff. We've tried to do a lot of things, my buddy and I, over the years, and some of them have worked and some of them have gotten made, but a lot of them have been deemed too weird. And it's always like, I don't know what that means. And I often sit and go, is it really that weird? You know, and then I see other things that get made that I think are actually kind of weirder, actually. But you know, I don't know how these guys' minds work. So
I think what I'm hearing you say, and what I think from watching how conservative film and TV can be, is just how expensive it is to produce. And so I think people are like less likely to take risks if there's a ton of money and time involved. And that's one of the pluses, Paul, about writing books, is it's just you in a room and it doesn't cost anything.
I keep thinking that.
It's like a movie in your head.
Totally. Totally. Absolutely. Yeah. No, and that's why it's also so much more appealing even than acting, because acting is so contingent on everybody else letting me do it.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, so the writing thing, that's very much why writing seems so appealing to me. I'm going to make this
well,
thing.
Well, let's keep talking. But in a way, I mean, just thinking about acting being contingent, I want to say too, just how remarkable it is that you've been able to have this incredible career that you've had. You know, you've played so many roles and you've been doing this for so many years. And that must feel like something of a small miracle at times, you know? I mean, yes, really, it's just hard. Yeah. I mean, for anyone to maintain an acting career for so long.
Yes, it is. Yes, so, it is. It's really, it's a crazy way to make a living. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
I want to end with my three final questions that I ask every guest as a way of anchoring the series.
Cool.
So first of all, in subtle or unsubtle ways, looking back on your life, how, if in any way, has the idea of death animated your work and life?
Oh, wow. I would say that it's been a very important and present thing literally in my life. There's been lots of people who have died. On me. And so it's been a very present thing. It's really interesting that you ask about it in my work too. I mean, I think about death a lot, and, you know, not necessarily morbid ways or anything, but I think about it a lot because it's happened a lot. I've had to play a lot of characters for whom, whether they know it or not, whether I know it or not, death feels very present. You know, the guy in Sideways and the guy in The Holdovers and John Adams and stuff, this sense of mortality, this sense of anxiety about things feels like it touches on death. Again, this is the only time I've ever said this. Sometimes I find myself wondering how my characters think about God, which in a way is, I suppose, a way they think about death. So it's like, I do think that it's actually an important thing to me. For a character, because death's going to, what they think about death is going to expose a lot about who they are, you know? So consciously or unconsciously, I think I do think about it a lot in my work.
Yeah, that's a great answer. Thank you. My next question, if you could live forever, would you? Why or why not?
I mean, but there's so many other questions.
You can ask follow-up questions.
am I going to be whatever age I want to be,
or am I
going to
exactly,
just become
exactly
possibly
as you are now.
Fucked up and like as I am right now?
Right now, right or right when it happens.
Okay.
Right when it happens.
Okay, so it happens now.
Yeah. So my question is right now, if I could wave my magic wand and say, right. Okay, Paul, I'm going to take the current incarnation of Paul Giamatti and he can live forever in this state, yes or no?
I would do it because I got to know. I'm so intrigued. What's going to happen? Is there going to be like horrible heat death of the planet, but I'll survive somehow? Will I just be like wandering around alone? I mean, if I'm wandering around on this fucking hellscape of like this disaster, that won't necessarily be good. But I think I'm so interested in knowing that I'm even willing to take that risk.
Well, you are Dr. Faustus then. You've just come full circle into your own myth.
Yeah. No, I'd do it. Because I was like, come on, how can you not want to know? I can see why you wouldn't want to, necessarily. But I think I'd have to do it.
All right, my final question. Has your work changed your thoughts about death and what happens after?
I think it has. I mean, I think what I do, you know, talk about radical empathy, which we're told is a terrible thing. What I do for a living is I connect with people. Like, that's what I do. I create chemistry between me and other people. And I think that that's just widens perspective on things. And I think that I've come to a place of thinking some of the bonds that I have in life transcend the material, the must. This seems unbreakable. Some of these things, it must be something that survives death, which I didn't used to think. I used to consider myself an atheist, but I'm really not. And so I think that as a result of having done this over and over again, and all the sort of stuff that I'm allowed to experience and the ways that I'm allowed to experience other people and the bonds that I can form and stuff like that make me go, no, this can't just be it.
That's wonderful. I think that's really beautiful, Paul. Thank you.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for asking.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being part of the show. It's been such a pleasure to have this conversation with you.
It was awesome. Yeah. Thank you very much for having me. Yeah.
All right. So here we are after the interview. My colleague Jess and I like to get together and discuss right after the interview what our thoughts are. So I learned a lot this time. I didn't know Paul as well as some of our other guests, and I thought he was fascinating talking on the topics that I was curious about. I'm not even sure where I'd start. What would you say, Jess?
Yeah, there was so much there that was so fascinating. So Paul Giamatti, I was familiar with, you know, as part of popular culture. I'd seen the episode Eulogy of Black Mirror, which is very dark. And I watched The Holdover last night in preparation for this, which I really loved. I love the relationships within it, and I highly recommend it. But yeah, to go to the start of the conversation, his interest in beings that change form, like Wolfman and Werewolf and Jekyll and Hyde, and the parallels that you guys made there with acting, I found that really interesting, actually.
Yeah, me too.
I wonder if there's many actors that I wonder if that's like a common thing.
I wonder if they're all aware of it, you know? I'll bet it's playing out, but I think he's such a well-read man and such a sophisticated thinker, obviously, you know? I'm not sure everyone thinks about it in those terms, but I'll bet a lot of actors would have some nod of recognition if they heard that said.
Mm, absolutely. And around that time, you guys mentioned The Island of Dr. Moreau. What is that?
It's a horror movie from the 30s, I want to say.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he made those parallels with interests in hoax and con artists and tricking people. And then you kind of made that connection between the liminal space that acting holds, which I just thought was really interesting. And again, that connection between acting, channeling something almost like a possession or a creativity channels.
That's one way of looking at it for sure, you know? How do you get your ego mind out of the way and bring in something else, I think, is one of the essential questions of all creativity.
Mm. And I completely wasn't aware of Art Bell.
Yeah. I mean, you're also British, but even in the United States, a lot of younger people wouldn't have heard of him. He was like the first. I mean, now it's common to have people who are into UFOs and conspiracy theories. He was the first. And I hope you got the sense listening to us talk. There was something really eerie and transgressive feeling about his broadcast. It felt like it was coming from nowhere, from some hidden world. And there was something very dark and frightening about it in a way.
I think I would love them.
I think you would, actually.
Right up my street.
Yeah, you should look it up.
Well, listening to it, I was thinking, well, are these publicly available? Could we make them publicly available? Could we get Paul to intro them, you know?
I believe they are publicly available, but we'll have to look into that.
Yeah, I'm going
to
look into it.
Yeah, but let me know.
When you guys talked about Lodge 49, you know, I could see Paul's face light up. That was clearly a really important project to him, and he was glad to talk about it. Something that you enjoyed too. I had a question. When you guys were talking about, well, he was talking about Philip K. Dick.
Philip K. Dick was a really influential science fiction writer. He wrote, did you ever see the movie Blade Runner?
Yeah.
He wrote the book that's based on Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? And many, many other movies have been made from his books. He's incredible. He also, oh my God, we had a whole class on Philip K. Dick and I can't even sum him up, but he had like a transformative, unexplainable paranormal experience that led to all of his writings, he would say, I think. So he's a really interesting character.
Sounds like another rabbit hole I can go down. Fantastic.
Oh, you have no idea how long that rabbit hole is.
I look forward to it. That's what I love about these conversations, that all these things come up. And finally, I loved his answer about if he could live forever.
I did too.
I like the thought that he was, you know, he's like, I want to know what happens. I'm so interested, you know, this vision of him wandering alone in a hellscape. It's very kind of sci-fi in itself.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Thank you so much for joining us on Memento Morbid. Don't forget, if you have your own Memento Morbid, a story, memory, or reflection, perhaps even a question, please send us a WhatsApp voice note. You will find the number in the episode description. Just add it to your contacts. To find out more about Morbid Anatomy and our happenings, you can visit our website at morbidanatomy.org. You can also find us at Morbid Anatomy on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok, or check out our Substack at morbidanatomy.substack.com.
Momentum Morbid is produced by Overcoat Media in partnership with Morbid Anatomy. I'm your host, Joanna Ebenstein. The series producer is Jess Gunasekra. Studio engineer, Fernando Velasco. Additional production and sound design by Katie Hill. Executive producer, Stephen Rajam.